Fast forward to the end of 2024. Think of your goals. What can you do right now to give yourself the best chance of succeeding? If you want to learn a new language, you absolutely should get Babbel. Be a better you in 2024 with Babbel, the science-backed language learning app that actually works. Don't pay hundreds of dollars for private tutors or waste hours on apps that don't really help you speak the language. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. I absolutely love Babbel because their courses help me learn real-life conversational skills. It's so easy to learn how to order food, ask for directions, speak to the locals without having to consult language apps. Babbel has over 16 million subscriptions sold. Plus, all of Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by their 20-day money-back guarantee. Here's a special limited-time offer for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, at babbel.com/SPP. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/SPP. That's spelled BABBEL.com/SPP. Rules and restrictions may apply.
The podcast where we talk to smart people, but not necessarily done by smart people.
That is an awesome question.
This one goes down probably on one of my top five.
Hey, I like nutrition. I like to eat food.
This is the coolest thing ever. We're going to do this forever.
I wish I paid more attention in that class.
You know, I'm going to be honest. I don't understand that. As a man, I don't get it.
Welcome to SmartPeoplePodcast.com.
Hello and welcome to Smart People Podcast, conversations that satisfy your curious mind. Chris Stemp here. Thanks so much for tuning in. This week on the show, we are talking with Patrick Ledden. And Patrick is an interesting guy. It was really fun to sit down and talk with him. I've actually known Patrick for about 7 years or so, I think it is. We worked together when we were at Franklin Covey. And as you're going to learn, he's got a really fascinating background. Patrick served as a U.S. Army master parachutist, infantry. He was an Army Ranger, right? You know those badass guys? Like, he was one of them. But then after that, he turned in the parachute and the combat boots for suit and tie, and he worked at KPMG. Then he eventually started a consulting business with his wife, which he runs today. He's also a speaker, a consultant, a professor at Vanderbilt, and an author. This week on the show, we are primarily talking to him about his new book, which is called The 5-Week Leadership Challenge. And this book is a hands-on, actionable book with bite-sized lessons from Patrick, ranging from what he learned on the battlefield to the boardroom. We also talk about other things. We talk about relationships, marriage, families, balance, careers, learning, growth. It's this wide-ranging, curious conversation, which this podcast is all about. So listen, as you start those holiday plans and you're gathered around family, first and foremost, we want you to be safe. We hope that you are well and you get some much needed relaxation over the holidays. The past year or two have been a doozy and it's been a challenge. I hope that this show, this podcast can create some bit of enjoyment, distraction, camaraderie. If it has, let me know what you think. Reach out. Tell me. Chris at smartpeoplepodcast.com. Love to hear from you. If you want to support the show, patreon.com/smartpeoplepodcast. Ad-free episodes, guest access, and more. And tell a family member, tell a friend, subscribe to Smart People Podcast. All right, let's get into it. We're talking to Patrick Ledden about his new book, The 5-Week Leadership Challenge, 35 Action Steps to Become the Leader You Are Meant to Be. Enjoy. Let's get started. Patrick, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, Chris. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I was looking forward to this. I remember, you know, when I first started at Covey, I remember doing an event with you. And I remembered I was like getting to know you and you were telling me you were a ranger and you used to parachute out of like airplanes and stuff. And I remember going, that seems like a far cry from what we're doing here. I have to figure out how that transition happened. And even I don't know the story. So I'm interested to like learn about how you got here and now you're this successful author and all that.
Yeah, it's interesting. At some point in your life, all of a sudden you become, tell me the story type of
thing.
And I've kind of hit that point, I guess, in life. But all of us have stories, obviously. But mine started out of high school. I actually joined the National Guard and went to basic training like when I was 18. And I was kind of good at it. They told me to turn left, I turned left. They told me to shut up, I shut up. They told me to do the things and I just kind of followed the instructions. And so when I went off to college, I thought, well, I'll just kind of keep following this path for a while. And I ended up going into the military, active duty full time after college, and spent about 6.5 years in service. I was in the infantry and I went to Ranger school, like you mentioned. I went to airborne school one summer in college, actually. I went to jump master school. I went to a unit called the 82nd Airborne Division and had a chance to be a platoon leader and a company executive officer and a company commander in the 82nd, which was a pretty neat experience. It's funny because all the people that I served with back in the quote unquote day, some of them have done some amazing things. I was telling somebody the other day that when I was a company executive officer, which is like the second in charge of about 120 person unit, I was a first lieutenant, and my battalion commander, who was a few ranks above me for sure, but he would also sign off on my evaluations, you know, that type of role, is currently the Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin. So it's you watch what other people do in your career and go, okay, well, I'm doing all right, I guess, but they're doing really well. You surround yourself with people. It's really interesting. You know that. And then I went to KPMG consulting after I came out of the military. Mm. So I did KPMG for a few years and was a project leader there and was working on predominantly one of two streams of work. One was more financial analysis type of work. But it quickly morphed, the project I was on specifically kind of started to morph more into like human capital, people development type of work. And that just really resonated with me. Mm. And then this is back in the day when monster.com started showing up and everybody was putting their resume. Folks who aren't familiar, it's an online recruitment tool or sourcing tool, staffing place. And it was kind of new in the day. So I went on monster.com and I put my resume out there just because that's what people were doing. And sure enough, I got a note from Franklin Covey. And they hired me away from KPMG.
So I went to work. When was that? Covey.
That would have been 2001. Yes, oh, okay. 20 years ago now.
Okay.
In fact, I was working at Franklin Covey on 9/11. I remember that specific. Obviously, wow. Like most of us would. I worked at Franklin Covey for just a really short period of time, Chris, actually, because I kept coming home to messages from a former client of mine who said he had work that he wanted me to do. And I talked to my friends at KPMG and they're like, yeah, if you want to do it, do it. And the problem was, I just didn't feel like I had the bandwidth to do it. Mm-hmm. So I told them thanks, but no thanks. But over the course of dinner one night with my wife, I obviously mentioned this guy and this project he wanted done. And one day I came home from work and my wife said, remember that conversation you mentioned the other day? I said, yeah. She goes, well, I reached out to him and I told him I could do it because she could. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, he hired her. So then I would come home. I come home from my Franklin Covey job, and in the evenings until like 1 o'clock in the morning, we're working on this other project. Wow! And this other project was essentially a large organization that had identified a pool of high potential employees in the organization. They wanted to invest and send them off to a graduate studies program, and they were trying to find the right school to partner with. So that was what the project was, and they had identified what we're interested in with the school, but we're not sure which one, and we'd like a third party to look. So that's what the project was. So over the course of doing that project in the evenings, it got to the point where I was like, this is like a second job. Like literally, right. Like some people listening to Smart Men know what I mean. They're doing a side hustle type of thing. Yeah. And so one day we're sitting on the couch and I said to my wife, I said, I think we really have a business here because this thing is growing and we need to make a decision. Are we going to go all in? In fact, the couch that we were sitting on, I don't ever want to get rid of that couch. It sits in the room just adjacent to where I'm at right now. And that's the couch where the conversation happened.
Yeah.
So I went to Franklin Covey and I said, I felt bad. I mean, I'd only been there 6 months or so.
Right.
But this thing's really taking off. And I think I'm going to get on this train and ride it for a while. And they were so kind to me at the time because they said, well, how about we be your second client? So then,
no way.
Yeah. So Franklin Covey actually became a client of our company and our revenues grew right away, which was nice to have, you know, somebody going from salary to revenue essentially.
Right.
But so we worked with Covey, and then 11 years later, after having a few offices that we'd opened and a really great team of people and a great client list, somebody came along and offered to buy our company from us. And it was like one of those stories you have where it's like you start a business above your garage and it goes into something that people want to buy. And then I said to them, great, we'd love to sell it. Well, was kind of like, really? Okay, what's that like? And, you know, eventually we sold the business to them, but I carved out the relationship with Franklin Covey and I said, I'd like to keep that relationship and sell it as part of the contract. So then I went over to Franklin Covey full time for a few years. So that's how I ended up having such a long run with them. Gotcha. And then about 8 years ago, I decided, I think I'll put that doctorate to use that I kind of picked up along the way.
Right.
And I applied to get a job at Vanderbilt.
I remember that.
I've been teaching. This is my, I taught a couple summers and then I've just started my, I believe, seventh full year as a professor at Vandy.
Nice. So a couple of things to unpack there. I mean, I definitely want to spend some time early on because you can tell the nice narrative, but like this podcast started out of the fear of, you know, when I'm 21, what do I want to be when I'm 40 and how do I get there? And then the narrative looking backwards, the famous Steve Jobs quote, like, I think it does work, but it's scary when you're early on. So first of all, when you were, you know, 21, 22, 23, whatever it was, you're jumping out of planes. You said a lot of military terms that, frankly, I'm unfamiliar with. Did you have any sense? Do you remember at that age being like, what do I want to do with my life? Or were you just like, this is fun? Or, you know, what was it at that point?
Well, sadly, I think that the truth be told, I probably had no sense of what I want to do with my life at all until I hit that point at about 17 where I was like, okay, what are you going to do now when you get out of high school? I mean, probably it was just in that mindset, right, wrong, good, bad, or indifferent. Because quite frankly, nobody ever asked me, what do you want to do with your life?
Yeah.
I grew up on the south side of Chicago and it just wasn't a conversation that came up that often. So when I was 17, I was kind of going, well, you know, I could go to college, but there's really no way to pay for college.
Right.
And a buddy of mine joined the National Guard. So I was like, what do you do that? And he said, well, it pays for college. I'm like, that sounds good. So, I mean, there was a little bit of like no planning at all, quite frankly, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because you're exactly right, Chris. The resume or the story going in arrears sounds so great.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, other people might be like, didn't sound that great, but whatever. I mean, it's my story, right?
It's your story.
We can make it sound pretty good. But I'll also tell students when students will be like, hey, Professor Legan, can I grab a cup of coffee? And we're sitting down and they're like, I looked at your profile on LinkedIn. How did you get your career? I want a career like that type of thing. And it's like, I tell them, like, dude, it's all the white space on the resume is where the lessons happened.
Yeah, that's all a good one.
You know, these are just the highlights. These are the high points.
Yeah.
And thankfully, and I'm sure your listeners are familiar with like names like Brené Brown and other people who have made it okay to be a little bit more vulnerable.
Yeah.
Allows us to tell the rest of the story, which I think is really what helps people out. So when you said, tell me about yourself. Yeah. All I did is let me water ski over the top of the stuff, not go down into like the dark, deep waters where it was a mess.
But
plenty of those.
I actually think that's really important. I loved what you said there about the lessons happen in the white space. I just heard not too long ago, it was this, hey, if you're interviewing for a company and you feel like your resume doesn't make sense, or there's a lot of gaps, here's how to handle it. And their advice was essentially, focus on the pivot points. Like I went from finance to sales to consulting to L&D. Like it's a weird, weird background, but all the pivot points were just that and they were pivotal. And I think they made me better at the one after it. And so to your point, I don't think that gets said enough. It's like, does it tell a linear story? Whereas today I find employers, leaders, movers and shakers want to know, can you adapt? Can you work through change? Can you be better in the next thing than you are today? And that happens with these pivots, like you were talking about.
I agree. And the funny thing is, I think that 30 years since I started my career now, I've been married 30 years. So I know we got married right after college. So 30 years out there in the workforce, the reality is that my career probably boils down to about 10, 15 decisions.
Mm.
Those moments, like the moment on the couch saying, are we going to go all in on the business or whatever it might be, or the moment where I said, how am I going to pay for college? I mean, those are the moments where it's like, those are the points and you don't know when they're going to come.
Mm. Now that can be a good thing or a bad thing, right? That could sound great. Like, okay, I'm going to have decision points, but then you go, what if I get them wrong? So what would you say? I mean, look, you deal with this in students. That's why it's a cool conversation.
Yeah.
What about when they say, yeah, I'll be faced with them, but I don't have that guiding North Star. And it sounds like you didn't necessarily either, and it still seemingly worked out.
Well, I don't think that there's any one route that is the route. So I think that the nice part, like you mentioned about kind of bouncing around doing different things in your career or my career, although I can tell it like a linear story, there are different things that I ebbed and flowed in, and maybe you kind of hit a cul-de-sac, you come back out and go a different direction really quick. So I don't think that there is a one route. I do think that you probably, if there were parallel universes, you could see other versions of yourself that probably had really, you know, successful careers or experiences in life. But I have this, I'm going to steal something from a friend of mine. There's this guy named Jason Hodell. He's the CEO of Skullcandy. So people know the headphone company, Skullcandy. Oh, yeah. And I've known Jason for about 30 years. He actually, interesting guy. He went to West Point. He ended up in the military right next to me because Hodell and Ledin, you know, kind of close to the alphabet. We ended up in the same platoon in office infantry officer school. And we ended up being Ranger buddies in Ranger school. So I credit him helping me get through Ranger school. And I think it's the other way around as well. Jason's career after the military, he went to Wharton and studied finance. Then he went to New York and got investment banking. And that's quite a grind of a type of job.
Yeah.
And then he made a pivot where he had played volleyball in college and he really was into beach volleyball. And somebody came along to him and said, "Hey, would you run the International Beach Volleyball Association?" Wow. And he's like, "I love volleyball. I like the idea of leading. I'll do that." And he did it for a while. And it was really like, you know, this is probably not the best fit for me, and kind of had to step back and go a new direction. And you would look at it right now and go, "Wow, look at his career. It's all these amazing spots," which he's had a great career. But one thing he says to my students when he talks to them sometimes is he says, "Yet you can be micro wrong, but you need to be macro right." And I think that's a really interesting thing to think about. In other words, your day-to-day life is full of lots of decisions. But then there's a couple big decisions you got to kind of make sure you make them right. And what he would say, for example, is go into an industry that's a growing industry would be an example of a macro decision, as opposed to when you make a macro decision, you know, follow, not that you don't want to follow your passion, but following your passion into a dead end industry isn't particularly helpful, right? So the idea of like, that's a macro decision, but in the day to day, we make all sorts of decisions. So I think at the end of the day, I look at it and say, you know, there's lots of different paths that you could follow in life, and people would probably end up in really great places, just different places. Mm-hmm. And the reality, I like the idea of Jason, is, you know, there's a few decisions you make in life and you try to do your best you can to make sure that you make those big decisions well.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And even if you make some of the micro ones or even general macro wrong. So for example, I remember when I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do after finance, I was like, you know what, I'm going to try something I'm really passionate about, which was golf. So I said, I'm going to go try and be a club pro. And I went and I worked at a golf course, right? Here's why the macro decision of that was wrong, because I went from making six figures to making like $15 an hour. Yeah. And in an industry, if money was an issue, all these things, and was I even good enough? But it was only about a 6-month thing. And it was so that when I get to 80 or 90, I don't go, "I wonder if I would have tried that thing out." You know what I mean? So even if it was technically not a great outcome, I would never go back and not want to try that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think there's a point where you realize, you explore the path. And then if you realize, okay, this is not the right path, the ability and the willingness to go, okay, I'm going to turn around and go a different direction. Let me give you an example of my own career, Chris. So when I came out of the Army, I went through this recruiting firm. It was this kind of the top headhunter of people coming out of the military. And I got a job with a pharmaceutical company. And the job was down in Texas, and I was going to do pharmaceutical sales. And seemed like a good enough job, so I'm going to go do that. And I went down to Texas to start the job, and I went down without my wife and then two kids at the time. And their son had just been born. I get down there, and I meet my boss, and I'm kind of settled into a residence inn or some type of temporary living space. And about a week into the job, I'm like, okay, so how does it work for my wife and kids to come down? And he's like, "What are you talking about?" I'm like, "Well, like relocation, how do I get them down here?" He's like, "Well, we gave you a plane ticket. You figure out the rest of it." And there were a couple of the warning signs where I'm like, "Oh, this is not the right place to be, or at least not the right person to work with." Because, you know, a lot of times our organizations are boiled down to the relationship with your boss.
Right.
So that was kind of what I saw there. So at that point, it was kind of like, okay, do I double down on this situation, or is it just clearly not a good path? And I backed out and I left, and I went back and we lived at my in-laws for a little while, and I didn't have a job. And I mean, all that type of thing before I landed the gig at KPMG. So it isn't like, you know, you tell the narrative, like, "Oh, I left the Army and I went to KPMG." It's like, "Oh, let me tell you about this little thing that actually happened."
Yeah.
That probably wouldn't come up in most conversations, and I probably 20 years ago didn't want to talk about that thing.
Really?
Like, well, because it's kind of like, I made this mistake and I don't, you know, but now it's like, how do people learn if I don't talk about that mistake?
That's what I was going to say. You know, I think that's so important, because so much of our life is spent in those mistakes. Like, whether it be, this is what I wanted to ask you. I wanted to ask you, in the narrative you told, and by the way, if people are wondering, like, why are we discussing this? I find it fascinating. You know, Army Ranger, you were just saying you didn't have a clue what you wanted to do. It wasn't like you were like, here's where I'm going to go. Army Ranger, kind of go through KPMG consulting, kind of stumble into Covey, but then realize maybe I have a business, and then start a business, not with the goal of exiting, just starting with your wife. And then you do exit. And I mean, it's a path. And then where you are today, you know, best-selling author, new book hits Wall Street bestseller list. Like, you know, so on the CV, you go like, man, made it. Professor, yeah. Great school, made it, da-da-da-da, talking, influencing thousands, tens of thousands. But it's a unique path. That's why I'm asking. So where along the way, or let me rephrase this. What would you say to people who feel like they're on a generally good path? They feel like, okay, I'm leveraging some skills and talents, but a good amount of their time is spent in struggle, or perhaps even they don't like it. You know, what is your stance on doing something maybe you don't love, you don't always like, but you're doing it because of other reasons, other goals, things like that?
Well, I think they call it work for a reason. It's work, right? So every day is not Pollyanna high-fiving everybody in the hallway. And there's days or periods of time that you're going to do things that you don't want to do because you see yourself going towards something bigger. And I mean, Stephen Covey said that, you know, you will forego, you know, short-time benefits for long-term goals. I totally destroyed the quote, but you get the idea. Right?
Good enough.
So he calls it short-term sacrifices for long-term goals. Hey. And that is true. I mean, the idea of, you know, going to work and dreading the Monday morning meeting for 2 months. Sometimes you have to do that in order to get through, and something else will come along within the job, or, you know, it's going to change, or it's a project you're on or whatever. So I'm not a big advocate to go, well, day one, when you don't like it, pull the plug, move on to the next thing, because guess what? That's going to repeat itself over and over and over. And all of a sudden you're going to start to realize there's a pattern going on in your life where you're constantly pulling the plug.
Yeah.
And then you're looking for other people to blame for that. But I do, I also think there are times when you clearly realize, okay, this is not going in the right direction. Mm. And to me, it isn't like, you don't just look inward and decide what you want to be and then scream it out to the world. And everybody has to, you know, then, you know, do what you want them, what you, you know, react in a way because based upon who you say you are type of thing. I think there's a bit of, you look inward and think about your purpose and your meaning, but you're also looking outward and seeing what the needs are in the world. And I think those two things combine to help you decide when am I on the right path and when am I not on the right path for yourself. So I think the bottom line is, Chris, you know, work is tough sometimes. Work is a struggle sometimes. Sometimes in the process of getting to whatever goal you set for yourself, you're going to have to do things. But if it was easy, everybody would do it.
Yep.
So, yeah, there were times in the military where I absolutely couldn't stand my job for a while. And then there's other times, you know, 6 months later, where it was going really great.
Right? That's what I was going
to
add.
I'm glad I endured the tough time to get to the better time.
And now a quick word from one of this week's sponsors. This week's episode is brought to you by Marketing Today with Alan Hart. If you enjoy listening to all the smart folks and smart people podcast, and you have an interest in marketing, we think that you'll love Marketing Today with Alan Hart. Marketing Today with Alan Hart podcast is focused on interviewing top marketers behind the brands and campaigns we see every day. Marketing Today is used at top business schools and business education programs around the world. With over 280 episodes, you'll find interviews with the CMOs of Peloton, MasterCard, GE, Pepsi, and many more. Listen to top global marketing thought leaders, including bestseller authors like Seth Godin. Search all of these on their website or subscribe to their newsletter to be alerted with a new interview each week. You can hear for yourself by going to marketingtodaypodcast.com. Again, that's marketingtodaypodcast.com. And now back to the episode.
Yeah, that's why I was thinking, wow, this is an interesting take on it. I think it makes a lot of sense, but I wonder how much of it was influenced by, I can't imagine training to be a ranger is like a great day every day. It's like, yeah, I want to wake up and get yelled at and get be in pain and all those things. You know, do you think
we started with the wake up and we didn't get really sleep? So
right. So like right there, I'm out. Like sleep on my value list right here at top. So I'm out. Do you think that or how much of an impact do you think that has had on your life? That discipline, that grind? I don't know anything about it. It's a foreign world, but I'd imagine you could be like in a meeting you don't want to be in and go, well, this is nothing and compared to, you know, what I did earlier.
There is a bit of me. There is a bit of me that when I'm in a bad meeting or something and I feel like, oh, this stinks, I just think about what somebody else is going through that day. Like somebody else is showing up for Ranger School that day. And kind of explain a little bit, because you said there were some terms that I mentioned, and I apologize for that, that may not have made sense. But Ranger School is essentially for the conventional military. So you think about like the conventional army, it's probably the most elite and challenging course that we have. There's obviously things like Navy SEALs or people working special operations more generally. That's more like specialized type of things. So if you were to put Ranger School against SEAL training, I mean, clearly there could be a huge debate about that. But if you think about Ranger School in general, it tends to be more of an en masse type of thing. A larger group will go through. Mm. When I went through, it was 68 days in duration was the minimum stay at the hotel. And it consisted of four different phases. Each phase was approximately 2 weeks or so. And there was one phase in Georgia, kind of at Fort Benning. It was supposed to be typical North American terrain. Then there was 2 weeks out in Fort Bliss, Texas, which was a desert phase. Then there were 2 weeks in Dahlonega, Georgia, which was mountain phase. And then there was 2 weeks down in Eglin Air Force Base down in Florida in the Panhandle, which was swamp phase. So they're kind of moving you through four geographic kind of settings. And each location, you spend the majority of your time awake. You get less than 4 hours sleep per night. Back when I went through, we got one meal a day. And it was a high calorie meal. It was one of those meals ready to eat type of meals.
But so it was delicious.
Yeah, it's delicious. And you get one, and you spend about 17 hours a day on average with your backpack, your rucksack on your back, carrying it around with a lot of weight in it. And the whole thing is like it stresses you physically, it stresses you mentally, because you have everybody has a leadership role they have to perform, and your leadership roles are evaluated. So if at the end of each phase, if you didn't past the leadership role, you get sent back through that phase. So they call people recycled. They keep getting recycled. People will spend up to a year trying to get through that school. So it's pretty high that way. Injuries will get you knocked out, and we do some parachute jumps and some other things just inherently that are dangerous. So you can get injured that way. The one you don't want to have is what they call lack of motivation, which basically means you just quit. That kind of follows you.
Really?
But also, like the day you show up to Ranger School, they do your physical fitness test. And it's push-ups, sit-ups, chin-ups, and then a run. And everybody who shows up, you know, you don't just show up one day like you're walking through Walmart and you go, I think I'm going to go to Ranger School today. Right. I mean, you're preparing for this thing, right?
All right.
But the number of people that don't make it through that physical fitness test was phenomenal. I was shocked by it, because my wife that day took myself and two other guys that morning and dropped us off at Ranger School. And about 2 hours later, those other two guys went home.
Really?
And they're really good shape. But the thing is, the instructors they don't want to count all your pushups.
Right.
So, you know, you need to do 35 pushups, you better do 100 type of thing. Or they do some mental things there where they'll say something like, okay, the next thing is to run. And they won't tell you how far or how fast.
I've
you have to
heard
go.
That. Yeah. How far? So, yeah. That is evil.
Yeah. Yeah. So stuff like that, you know, kind of causes people to get knocked out. And
yeah,
Chris, I was lucky, prepared. I wasn't more prepared than most people, but I made it through in 68 days. My son-in-law actually went through Ranger School and he graduated a few years ago. He got injured at one point and recycled, but he made it through, which is huge. But I know other people who didn't make it through at all, which is they got injured or something happened to them. So it's about a 50% or more attrition rate. Mm. And it's just right place, right time.
Do you think natural traits, you know, characteristics that benefited you that you always had that got you through it?
I think there probably are some, but doesn't mean that if you don't have these traits, you wouldn't get through it, right?
Sure.
So for me personally, I have a high tolerance for ambiguity.
Mm.
I'm pretty comfortable being uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So if they say run, I'll just run. I know eventually they'll tell me to stop. I have a high level of being able to deal with crap sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So if you're like a person who doesn't suffer fools, if you can't handle, well, then you probably don't want to go there, because
right.
There are going to be some people that have just position or authority in that school over you, and they're the ones in the position type of thing. Mm-hmm. But I also I'm also pretty good. I always have been pretty good at goal setting and moving forward on things. So although, like I mentioned earlier, I didn't really have a lot of direction growing up necessarily. Once I kind of started to find the path or saw something I wanted to achieve, I quickly realized I was kind of good at that. So setting a goal, setting a target, going after it, accomplishing it, and then saying what's next.
Yeah.
Has always been something that's been a good trait for me. But like all of us, what's our strength sometimes is also our Achilles heel, because sometimes I don't enjoy the ride so much because I'm so focused on what's the next thing.
Yeah, that's one I struggle with. I see it a lot in where I work and things like that. I don't know. We just interviewed the former CEO of HubSpot and StubHub. And I remember her saying, you know, I'm always negotiating against someone. And I just think that oftentimes that's someone for me, maybe for you, is myself. It's like, okay, is this serving my professional goal, my personal goal, my family's goals? Like it's really hard. And I think in today's society, when there's so much information, we are aware now of maybe more that we should focus on. And what I mean by that is like my dad, I have these theoretical conversations and he's like, dude, when I was 25, I just wanted to make sure we could eat. Like, you know, I was poor growing up, like all this heady intellectual stuff you're worried about. I never thought about that. And guess what? My life was great. I mean, that's to an extent where he goes. And I'm like, wow, I think we suffer from sometimes too much awareness. Like, is that a thing? You know what I mean?
Well, I know I'm not a huge advocate of all the generations work that's out there. I mean, there's some things I think are interesting, but it's hard to say, you know, 74 million people behave a certain way, but I think there are some trends and things we can look at. It's a data point. There's plenty of other data points about somebody that might be more informative, right? Whether it's race, race, ethnicity, economic level, socioeconomic level, or education, or whatever it might be. But I do think there is one thing that is interesting to me. Because of all that information, their expectations have changed, I think, sizably to some extent. And what I mean by that is, you know, it's easy for somebody to say, well, when I was 25 years old, I knew that I needed to earn the right and I shouldn't ask for X, Y, Z. And I would be like, yeah, but if you were 25 years old and you could see that other 25 year olds were doing other things and moving around and jumping jobs and changing and getting opportunity, you're telling me you'd be content? Of course not. Right.
Yeah.
So it isn't like we don't have the desire. We just didn't have the path, or at least know those paths even existed.
Yeah.
So instead of like saying, well, you know, 25 year olds don't get it, it's like, sometimes I don't get it. Right. I need to realize that at 52 that, you know, that, so I think that that's really informed me, and being around students is always helpful to me too, to kind of watch their careers and see what they're doing. And I think that really does kind of calibrate you. You know, you mentioned about like your father. It's funny, when I was younger growing up, so I'm one of five kids. And so there were seven of us in the house, and our house, I've looked at it on Zillow. I can tell you exactly what our house was. Our house was 1,159 square feet. So it wasn't a very big home by most standards. It had one bathroom, which is an interesting challenge with seven people.
Yeah.
And then when I quote unquote made it in life type of thing, when I felt like I made it and our business was doing well, I built a house that was six bedrooms and six bathrooms and lots of square feet. And we were four of us.
Yep.
And guess what?
You didn't need it.
I didn't need it. Exactly. Now we live in a house that's, you know, a third of that size.
Yeah.
And we're very content with that. So I think that there are like these expectations we set for ourselves that once you get to them, sometimes you're like, it ain't all I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
And the question becomes, okay, what do you do now with it? Or what actually will fulfill you in that regard? So it's kind of an interesting thing. And I'm sure you've had plenty of people on your podcast. You've talked to plenty of people who think that this is the thing they want. And then they get it and they go, it's not it. It's empty.
Well, it's funny. Actually, you're saying that. I mean, yes, like, of course we talked about it, but one of the things I struggle with on that note is knowing it isn't enough. Like, I think most humans are destined to repeat that error over and over in their life, and then their kids and their kids and their kids. And I can't figure out why. Like, I know this. I've learned it so many times. My first car I bought was $50,000 Infiniti G35 brand new. I was making like $50,000. And I was like, but I really want a car. Within a year, I realized, dumb mistake. Haven't owned a nice car since then. But then sure enough, like, we bought this house. I was like, no matter what happens for the rest of my life, I made it. This is my house. Like, I earned it. 2 years later, I'm like, okay, what's next? Not necessarily what's next, what's bigger, but like, what is the next goal to accomplish? And it just, I don't want to think that way, but sometimes I wonder if we're just as humans meant to. There's no way around it.
Yeah, you know, Chris, it's funny you say that. So I'll tell my students, sometimes I'll say, back in earlier years, I'll say the day one more time, back in the day, I sound like I'm 200, but there was a time where when you were in the car driving along, you were limited to what music or station, you know, songs you could listen to based upon what stations you could pick up in the area you were in. Mm-hmm. As opposed to now, you know, talk about expectations, you know, demanding to play any song you want at any moment is a completely different expectation. So back in the day when I would be driving along in the car, maybe there's 10 radio stations you could pick up in Chicago or more. So the one of the problems I would run into, and this might relate to what you were just saying, is that I've noticed if there was a song playing, like if I turned to a station and there was a song playing and I liked that song, I mean, like I really liked that song and I would enjoy listening to that song. My natural tendency would be to go, what's on the other stations? Uh-huh. And I would go to two or three other stations or more trying to find mm-hmm. another song because there might be a better song out there for me.
Yeah.
And then what would happen is if you go through 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 other stations, you go, nope, that was the best song. By the time you get back to the best song, it's over or it's wrapping up type of thing.
Yep.
So that behavior of mine has haunted me my entire life. I continually do that. You know, I've learned to kind of temper it. Mm-hmm. Because I realize, you know, I do have the ability to think and reason and choose, but yeah. My tendency is to go, what else is out there? And, yep. You know, that might be fine if you're doing it in songs, but really bad if you do it in relationships,
good point.
Really bad if you're constantly doing it in jobs, really bad if, you know, something you have to figure out, like, when can you hunt and peck and look for the other songs on the stations? And when might you say, you know what, I picked this song and this is a great song and I'm going to dance and sing to it.
I like that analogy. And then how you mentioned it with relationships. I think that's one I remember in my early 20s and stuff, just kind of thinking along those lines, like one relationship forever. That seems like actually a raw deal, not a great sacrifice. But of course, now and having been married for a while and everything, you know, I can't imagine the alternative. And I think that making that decision and making it and sticking to it and knowing it's a non-negotiable actually takes a large weight off of my shoulders. And I think that could be true around a lot of decisions, like you were saying, with career, with external goals, is like having that long-term guide can really offset any short-term confusion or struggles or sacrifice you might see.
Yeah, I do think, though, that speaking relationships, so my wife and I, we celebrated 30 years about 2 weeks ago.
Congrats. And,
yeah, thanks. It's a big number.
And working together and owning a business and selling a business, like that's got to be hard.
So you want to talk about like the highlights of the resume, like you just went through there, sound great. Let me tell you, it's not. There were lots of hard times. And I think people need to hear those times too. Yeah. Because they're in my mind, I think early on in our marriage, I kind of decided, sticking to the analogy of the radio station, I've picked this song and I'm going to stick to this song. Like I stepped up there. And I said, I made a commitment to something and then that's going to be it. But then I wasn't always nurturing and investing in that relationship.
Yeah.
And that comes at a price. And there's mm-hmm. probably people listening to this podcast who didn't expect to tune in and hear that kind of conversation, but they might be dealing with it right now.
Right.
And I write about, and I talk about, you know, let me tell you about the low points in relationship too, and how, and I made some really dumb decisions. And fortunately, through grace from her and others, that, you know, we're able to recover from those things and move forward. But, you know, committing to somebody, a partner, whomever you might commit to, even a good friend that you might commit to, recognize it takes watering and feeding. Definitely. Yep. Yeah.
And now a quick word from one of this week's sponsors. This week's episode is brought to you by Get Abstract. If you're like Chris and I, you probably don't have that much time. You don't have that much time to read all the books, to listen to all the podcasts, to watch all the videos. So we have a solution for you. Get Abstract. Get Abstract finds, rates, and summarizes the top business books, articles, and video talks into 10-minute abstracts to help people make better decisions in business and their private lives. Get Abstract offers over 22,000 text and audio summaries in areas such as leadership, finance, innovation, health and science, and more. Get a free month of Get Abstract by visiting getab.li/smart. That's getab.li/smart. getab.li/smart. And now back to the episode.
Now, I appreciate that, and I agree. And you mentioned your writing, and I want to get into that. It's just as you were talking about this, the last thing I'll say on kind of making those commitments and reaping the rewards, I've got two young kids. They're 6 and 3. And there's been times literally where I'm like, this is impossible. Like through a pandemic, I mean, my 6-year-old, his first day of kindergarten, you know, it was going to be virtual and they're wearing masks and my 3-year-old had to be home. And now every cough you have to, I mean, I had to shove a swab up his nose last week because we thought it was COVID. I mean, it's crazy stuff. And I remember talking to my dad and he said, you know, yeah, it's hard. And there's things like that. He goes, but easily that as I, you know, now he's retired and stuff, the best part of my life is getting to come have dinner with you, your kids, things like that. And you just kind of, you realize like, you know, one, be able to enjoy the moment, but two, what are the long-term benefits you're going to reap, you know, rewards you're going to reap for the hard work you put in now? Same thing at being a ranger, you know, it's like, I'm going to go through these 2 months and what am I going to reap for it? Or I'm going to build this business and I'm going to come home and work at night. And what am I going to get from it? It's kind of the theme here, you know?
Yeah. And it's interesting too. I mean, the amount of reaping I've done from 2 months, I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah,
I mean,
not right?
People ask about range goal because it's kind of like that was 2 months right? When I was 22. But you're right that it's kind of the law of the harvest type of thing in certain regards. And we don't always know what's going to grow. You know, you mentioned Chris, your dad, you mentioned his name a couple of times, and I think it's really critical. And I didn't always recognize the importance of this, but I do now. And I have over the last probably 15 years or so. My dad's 90 and I have some conversations with him that I never would have had with him, which are really interesting conversations. So I would encourage everybody to, you know, whether it's a father or a father figure or an aunt, uncle, mom, good friend, whomever, you know, there's some people who have been further down the path than you and they can kind of put things in perspective. And I've learned to kind of value that. I actually, years ago, you're familiar with Franklin Covey, they have the 5 choices to extraordinary productivity.
Oh yeah.
And when they launched the 5 choices, I got a call. Actually, the 5 choices is what caused me to sell my business, which is kind of an interesting thing.
Wow. So
I got a call from Franklin Covey and they said, we're getting ready to launch this new program, which is kind of our, for simplicity's sake, you know, our newest version of historically our time management work. So it's time to talk about like, it's not just a time management challenge, it's a decision, energy, attention management. That's the challenge people have to deal with. We're launching this new program and we need somebody to kind of go out and be the face of it to some places. And I said, okay, what are the places? And they sent me a list of 175 cities. And they said, you pick which ones you want. If you ever get that offer in life, folks, I'm telling you, take it. So I took the offer and our oldest had just started college, but our youngest was in 8th grade. So my wife and we only have two, our youngest, our son, and my wife and I and our son, we left the country for like 3 months and we had our business at that point. And I came back from that trip around the winter holidays. And I was talking to a former boss of mine from KPMG who had since left and gone to another organization. And he was talking to me about, we were just kind of catching up, a little networking, check-in discussion. And he said, wait a minute, you've been gone for 3 months? I'm like, yeah. And he goes, and your employees didn't quit? And I said, no. And he said, your clients didn't quit? And I said, no. He's like, you want to talk to my boss? Because we're looking to acquire somebody. But the reason I mention all that is because in the launching of the 5 choices to extraordinary productivity, they have a section in there about thinking about the roles in your life. Maybe you remember this, like thinking about the roles in your life and identifying what extraordinary would look like in those roles.
Definitely.
And, you know, you're going to go out and teach something. So you probably need to invest some time doing it and understanding it. And I went through the process. I took the circle that they said, divided up like a pie, label the roles in your life that are kind of the most critical roles right now, 5 or so. And then assess where you stand. Are you doing a normal job? Are you underperforming? Are you overperforming? What are you doing? And I wrote down son, S-O-N. And at this time, I'm about 41, maybe. And I thought, how am I doing as a son? And I gave myself somewhere between underperforming and normal. I mean, if you were to call my parents at the time and you say, you know, is Patrick a good son? They'd be like, yeah, he's a good son. He calls periodically, you know, he checks in or whatever, or routinely probably. But then if you like dig into it, if I'm honest with myself, I'm like, well, what are those conversations like? what's the weather?
Right.
What's going on in Chicago? Let me tell you what's going on where we live. Yeah. Yeah, very, very topical type of things. And they're very almost, you could talk to a stranger on a train about. And I decided, you know, I'm going to double down on this one. So I go off on launching that program for Franklin Covey, and I start calling my parents and asking them questions about, our kids are dealing with this. How would you handle it? And it was just never a type of conversation we had, because at 17, I basically joined the military in my mind and I was kind of gone. Yeah. And when I came back from the 3-month trip overseas, I was at a hotel, I was at the airport in Dallas, and I was talking to one of my brothers, and he said, you need to come home. And I said, why, what's going on? He said, mom's sick. I said, well, she'd been sick for a while. I said, how about I'm going to go back to Louisville, which is where I was living at the time. And then my wife and I will drive up over the weekend. He's like, no, you need to come home right now. You know, you're not understanding.
Yeah.
And you know, when you have those situations where they say like somebody is dying, but they're waiting for the last person to show up.
Wow.
Yeah. I was the last person to show up. And I saw my mom that night, and about 2 hours later, she passed. And I remember just sitting there, and I'd gone to a hotel. We visited my mom, and I was going back down to Chicago. So we just saw her that night. And I stayed at a hotel, or going back from Chicago, staying in a hotel, got a call at 2 o'clock in the morning and said, mom passed away. And I remember just sitting there thinking to myself in the darkness, how glad I was that I invested in that relationship, that I took that exercise for real. Fast forward a few days, we're at the funeral. After the funeral, we go back to my dad, what is now my dad's house, right?
Yeah.
It was their home together. And if you've ever, people listening, I'm sure they've experienced this, where you go to a funeral and then you go back to the home and it just, everything just feels awkward. You're eating like cold sandwiches and making small talk, but clearly someone literally is missing. And it was that type of thing. And I remember I looked at my wife and I said, I'm so glad that I did that exercise and thought about the roles of my life and really doubled down on one. And she looked at me, my wife, Jamie looked at me and she said, you're still a son. And I was like, I'm a son. And I look across the room and there's my dad. And my dad described my father. My dad's about 5'6", and he's a 5'6" can whoop ass. He's just like, every morning, every day he'd come back home after, you know, work, doing his job, and he's got 5 kids, all that probably misbehaved, and he was going to bring them all back into control again. You know, he's just kind of that type of personality.
Yeah. So,
and my dad's also the kind of guy who, historically, if I said to my dad, I won the lottery, I want to buy you a new house or a new car, he'd be the guy who'd go, I got a house, I got a car, I don't need anything. You know, he just kind of has that kind of keep it a distance personality. And I walked up to him and I said, hey, dad, I travel a lot for work. Any interest in going on a business trip with me? And then I kind of like was defensively waiting for him to go, why would I want to do that? If I want to go somewhere, I'd go. And he said, where are you going? And I was like, pull my calendar out real quick. I'm like, I'm going to Topeka, Kansas next week. He's like, all right, I'll go with you.
Really?
Yeah. And I watched the arc of my dad's story change over the last, my mom passed away in 2011. So like the past 10 years.
Sure.
He happens to be a twin. So he's 90 and he has a twin. This is Smart People Podcast. So my dad's 90 and he's a twin. That means he has a 90-year-old twin, his sister. and she says in many ways, because of the pressure of work and now he's in retirement years and, you know, and having cared for my mom and her ailing health for so many years, he's slowly kind of, in a way, kind of decompressing through all of that. And he's become a much softer version of himself. So he's really an interesting guy to engage with in conversation.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. I mean, I appreciate you sharing that. I think, you know, it embodies a lot of why I love this podcast too, right? It's not, the goal isn't always just to talk about, we're going to talk about your book, talk about leadership, talk about the topic, but it's like, there's people out there. I find it so fascinating, you know, accomplished, thoughtful people dealing with similar things. And I just think we live in a time where we can connect on those things, reflect on how they impact our lives, and then change. Mm-hmm. And like, that's the key that I know you and I have a big focus on is like, and then change. And so you hear those things that might spark that. And I think it's important. On that note, I know we've got about 10 minutes left, and I do want to get into this book you wrote. It's called the 5-Week Leadership Challenge, 35 Action Steps to Become the Leader You Were Meant to Be. One of the reasons I want to talk to you about it, not just because I know you and I love your story and I know your experience, but I'm also curious, you know, you've dedicated, you could tell us, but what, two decades of your life to kind of being in organizations and things like that. Is that fair?
Yes.
You've seen it all. Okay. You've worked for, you've done work with one of the top leadership companies in the world, in Covey. I have to imagine at some point you were like, most things on leadership have been written. So I'm interested from your perspective, what made you go, this is what I need to say, I want to say, and knowing the challenge ahead, decide to put it in a book, put your stamp on it, and move forward?
Well, I want to respond to that one comment you made about most books have been written or things have been talked about. I do agree with that. I actually wrote a book years ago that's more of a fable or a leadership story. And in that story, I called the story Oliver's Spot. And Oliver, actually, his last name is Stanton, which was the name of one of my professors that I really liked. So I kind of kept it in there. But Oliver's Spot is the name of a bookstore in the book. And there's a leader who's struggling with some team performance issues. And she walks into the store and meets the proprietor, Oliver Stanton. And he actually says to her, he says, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, she asked about employee engagement. He said, yeah, there's a lot written about employee engagement, but maybe you'll just benefit from a conversation because a lot of these things say the same thing. So I even like had that premise in there in the whole story.
Oh, nice. Okay.
He doesn't sell her one book at all. He actually just talks to her about leadership is what the book is about. So this particular one, you know, you're right. There's been a lot written about leadership. I actually was talking to somebody the other day about, we know from, you know, scripture references through history, if you look at, you know, biblical references or other things, you know, the idea of nothing new under the sun. I think there's definitely we've talked about to excess about a lot of things around leadership. The problem isn't that we don't know it or we can't have access to it. Just sometimes we don't do it very well.
Right.
Sometimes we keep looking for the next opportunity woman that is sitting in front of us, like we were just talking about. Sometimes we don't want to have the conversation we know we need to have, even though we know we need to have it. And we've been told how to have this performance conversation with somebody. Sometimes we've been told ad nauseum about importance of setting goals or how to do it. We still don't do it. We were taught by kindergarten how to interact with people and like listen to them and share and be, you know, so we know all these things. The question becomes sometimes it doesn't sink in. So what I decided to do in this book is because I've had, at least in my opinion, a fairly interesting career. I've had exposure, not just things I've done, but just some of the people I've been around and what I've watched them do. So I wrote the book in a narrative setup where every day for those 35 action steps, every day you pull the book open and you read 2 or 3 page story about something around leadership that's in a framework that I use. And then you think about your own story and you answer some questions. So it's very workbook-ish in that regard.
Right.
And what I really try to make it be is, what I try to think about it is the book contains stories. People relate to stories. The book is written in a very digestible way in that it's 2 or 3, you know, 2 or 3 pages of reading, 10 minutes a day. The book is a process. It's not just an event. You don't just read it through from cover to cover right away. You should be taking your time to read it, whether it's 35 days or 35 weeks, just working your way through it. And then, but most importantly, it's relevant because, as I say in the book and I tell people, it's, hey, my stories are just, they're the vehicle to teach the idea, but you're answering the questions as you're writing your story. And that's kind of where I've landed with this idea of like, use my story to write your story. So like, I've had some crazy experiences, like sharing the stage with Iceland's prime minister and talking about, we spoke to an audience of 500 people together. Here's what I learned when I watched her, right? Or I talk about in there, like in the military, I'll tell some military stories, like jumping out of a plane at 2 o'clock in the morning and landing in the trees. What do you do in that moment type of thing? But then I also tell stories like I pulled in the garage and my wife was standing there and things weren't going well. And what do we do in that moment? So it's not all case study where it's like things were kind of going like this. Then I got my hand up, but you know, things are kind of at the status quo level. Then a change happened and performance dipped. And then guess what? We all ended up on top of the mountain together.
Right.
It's not that at all. It's fairly real. And you know, I say fairly real, not that I was like purposely guarding or not sharing something. It's just like, I'm just being objective about when you look at it, go, yeah, there was more you could have told there, more you could have told there, whatever. But each is a story where I'm just trying to encourage people to think about themselves. And I
love that.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Chris.
No, go for it.
I was actually, the way I came into writing this story or this book was I was actually in China one time. And I showed up in China to train some people on something. And then there was an event they were doing later on that week. And it was like a big event in a big ballroom in a hotel in Beijing. And they were going to have several hundred people in the room. Business people were going to come to this event. And there was literally the headliner of the event was a speaker that we all would know. Most people would know the name if I said the person's name. He was going to lead this presentation that day. And I was kind of the warm-up act. And nobody goes to see the warm-up act, right?
That's right.
I was envisioning, like, there's this emails flying around, you know, Beijing cyberspace saying, you know, come see so-and-so, author of this, that, and the other. And then at the very bottom in small font, it may have said, and Dr. Patrick Ledden or something like
right.
that. And he shows up the day before the event and he says to me, yeah, I think I'd like to do like 20 minutes. I'd like you to do 2 hours. Yeah. What? And I was like, what? And I was like, what? And he was very convincing. So the next thing I know, I'm back at my hotel room preparing to do 2 hours.
Wow.
And thinking in my head, nobody's coming to see me.
Right, right. Type of thing.
So at that point, what are you going to do? I mean, you're signed up to do 2 hours. You say, okay, to the guy, which maybe I shouldn't have, but I did.
Right.
I'm sitting in my hotel room preparing. And I'm thinking, what am I going to tell these people for 2 hours? And I decided I'm just going to tell them some leadership stories and tie them together into a narrative that I think would make sense.
And that's where this came.
I step up on the stage, finish the thing. After the event's over, he and I are jumping in a car to go someplace else in town. And he said to me, where do you get all the stories? And I was like, well, what stories? I'm just telling some things. And for whatever reason, I've become decent, probably survival tactic if nothing else, but pretty decent at telling a story with a point.
Right.
Right. And having people go midway through it, go, oh, I can see where he's going with this. And
then
it becomes less about, let me tell you about my story. It's just more of, I mean, we use story throughout history to tell our history, to tell our story, whether it's around a campfire in the past or a projector bulb in a conference room these days. But we sit around the fire and we tell stories. And that's kind of what I try to dial into.
I'd love to know with the last few minutes here, you know, 35 action steps, and it's hard, right? It's hard. You can't boil down your 20 years of experience. You can't boil down the hundreds and hundreds of organizations you've been in, the leaders you've worked with. But like, what are one or two action steps you feel like don't get enough coverage, but you believe are critical to leadership?
Well, the 35 action steps are broken down into 5 categories.
Okay.
And each category has 7. So I roughly wrote it as if you would read one day per day for seven days per week or 35 days over 5 weeks. I really made that sound very complicated. One day for 35 days over the course of 5 weeks.
There you go.
Thus the 5-week leadership challenge.
Yeah.
And I would say that at least I think a couple of key things. The first week I think is really critical because the first week is really just about how do you think as a leader? So it talks about a number of key things, including the reality that you're not going to be able to control everything and you get things done with and through other people and you've got to check your ego. And for me, one of the critical ones, kind of getting back to what we talked about earlier, is you got to also enjoy the journey. And the journey is going to have its ups and downs and ebb and flow. And, you know, you're not going to love every minute of it. And I use an example of my son and I hiked Kilimanjaro and how hiking that mountain was a great lesson for me about enjoying the journey, because being the task-oriented person I am, I'm thinking how much further to the top of this thing and how many more days of hiking and how far are we going tomorrow and what's the altitude? And, you know, give me all the things I can put in my list so I can check these things off. And our guide, Rashid, who had been to the top of the mountain 300 times, 300 times to the top of this mountain, basically kept telling me, chill out, enjoy the journey, right?
Wow.
He's an awesome guy. And to me, that was like a lesson of that I thought was important for some people who may be a little bit too task oriented. So I'd say the first 7 days are really critical as far as, you know, getting your head on straight as a leader. And then I think there's, you know, I would be remiss to say, well, they aren't all important to varying degrees, but when I look through some of the other ones, I can tell you the ones that resonated with a lot of people. There's one in there about, I call it address elephants. And the idea is that, you know, we all know in organizations, you probably know in your world too, that there's an elephant in the room, something that needs to be addressed. It could be a performance issue. It could be a lack of resources issue. It could be many things, a customer problem, whatever it might be. And we're all just kind of dancing around the subject. And I tell a story in that one about an issue that happened with one of our employees in the company that I owned. And I completely ignored it. I, for whatever reason, I pulled that chicken switch and didn't deal with the issue. Mm-hmm. And I give some reasons why we do that sometimes. And then kind of challenge the leader that day to think about what's something in your midst that you know is a baby elephant that's growing.
Yeah.
And if you don't address it, it's going to become a 14,000 pound pachyderm roaming the hallways. And, yeah. And so I talked about that day about things about it's your job to address these things.
Mm.
So even if you don't want to do it, too bad, it's your job to deal with this issue. Or, you know, small things become big things. Or the idea that you can't address an elephant in the room if you don't know what right even looks like. So sometimes you have to invest the time to learn what it's supposed to be so you can figure out when it's not that thing. And just challenging them to think about. So that's an example of a day. And that one really seems to resonate with people because I think a lot of us know of these issues. But I do think one challenge we often have with these elephants, for example, is we'll sit there and say, oh yeah, there's an elephant at work right now that needs to be addressed. And so-and-so and so-and-so better get to addressing it.
Right, right.
And what I really challenge you to think about is don't point to somebody else to address it. What can you do to get this thing moving in the right direction? So yeah, different lessons like that. The at the end of the day, people go through five P's. I am a former infantry guy, so I keep things very simple. So the first week, the mindset week, is about perspective. What's your perspective as a leader? The second week is about purpose. What's your purpose as a leader? What impact do you want to make? The third week is around priorities. How do you set goals for yourself and with and through other people? Then plans. How do you actually create plans to accomplish those goals? And then lastly, performance. And I talk about some things that you can do to increase the level of engagement of your people and also to make sure that you kind of are in the right spot at the right time to help them out. So that's the idea.
I was going to say, I love the framework. I love the narrative. I love the action orientation. Just as we get, you know, as you talk about leadership, I think today people are more overwhelmed than ever before. And it's like, I can't read through, you know, troves of, like you said, case studies and things like that. I know it exists, but hey, I just got promoted to a leadership role. I need to know what to do. Or I just went from peer to leader. How do I handle that? Right. All these things. And the simplicity doesn't mean it's simple. So yeah. Again, the book is The 5-Week Leadership Challenge, 35 Action Steps to Become the Leader You Were Meant to Be. Patrick, you know, of course, we're going to link to the book and things like that. But where else are you? I know you're big on LinkedIn. You've got your own podcast. Tell the audience where they can find you and learn more.
Sure. So, yeah, I am pretty well, I guess I would say well followed. That sounds silly.
Yeah, I know. Hey, let it go.
LinkedIn, it read my stuff. Yeah. So you can always, you know, follow me on LinkedIn. I put out an article every week. You can sign up for our newsletter at leadingroup.com. And we send out a newsletter every week. In the newsletter, you get a video of me, so you can see my smiling face every week talking about something. You get an article from me. You get a tool. We send out tools every week, so we create little tools. Sometimes they're infographics, sometimes they're forms, but we've been doing that for a long time. And then lastly, you get a podcast. We do a podcast that comes out every Wednesday where we talk to lots of different people about leadership, and they range from Major League Baseball players to CEOs of companies to authors of books and 13-year-old mountain climbers. So I try to talk to a lot of different people because I think all of us can teach each other's things about leadership. And then if you go to the 5-Week Leadership Challenge, it's the number 5weekleadershipchallenge.com. There you can read more about the book, and there's also an assessment you can take on that site for free, and we'll send you a free email with some ideas about what you can do. One of the things we found over the course of time, Chris, is that because we've been putting out content for a long time, I'm kind of a content machine. I like content. I like models. I like ideas. I like, you know, those type of things. So we've been putting out these things. We're at the point where we probably have on our own blog, you know, 500 articles, 300 or 400 tools, lots of 100 plus podcast episodes, all these type of things. So one thing that we like to do with when you take that assessment is we make some recommendations. Here are the ones we think you might want to listen to or read, type of thing. Yeah.
Nice. Well, Patrick, again, thank you so much. Congratulations on the book success. And I really appreciate you joining the show.
Thanks, brother. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it. Best of luck to you and everybody in your audience.
Thank you.
That was Patrick Ledin. I hope you enjoyed his interview, his book, The 5-Week Leadership Challenge, 35 Action Steps to Become the Leader You Were Meant to Be, is available wherever books are sold. All right, we are approaching the end of 2021, so we want to wish you a very happy new year. And if you celebrate Christmas, Merry Christmas. If you celebrate other holidays, happy holidays. And if you don't celebrate anything, we just hope you have a great last 11 days of 2021, and we'll see you in 2022. If you ever want to reach out to the podcast, you can email us at smartpeoplepodcast@gmail.com or message us on Twitter at Smart People Pod. And if you'd like to support Smart People Podcast, head over to Patreon, become a patron at patreon.com/smartpeoplepodcast. And if you'd like to stay up to date with all things Smart People Podcast, head over to the website smartpeoplepodcast.com and sign up for the newsletter. All right, that's it for us this week and for this year, 2021. But make sure you stay tuned because we've got a lot of great interviews coming up. And we'll see you all next episode.